It's Thursday, April 18th, 2013, and you're listening to episode 296 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 59 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name is John.
This is Wayne.
My name's Chad.
Only one quick announcement. Whether you're coming to Fear the Con or not, if you want a Fear the Con 6 t-shirt, we have one that we will be posting on our Cafe Press store. It will be up by the time this show is released. So I'll put a link to that in the show notes. And that's it. So let's get down to it. What do you guys want to do? You guys want to dive right into our kind of doubleheader topic thing here? You want to talk about Chad's issues of responsibility?
Let's talk about issues of responsibility.
All right.
It's a deep and dear topic.
Chad, go ahead and pose your question.
It's something about something.
Don't say.
There were some people talking on the forums about, I think this was actually a couple of different topics that people on the forums were talking about, where I think one guy was saying, it's like, well, I got this person coming to my group and I don't think they're really respecting me. And, you know, I provide the house and I provide the books and I provide the papers and pencils. And then I remember I was having a separate conversation about somebody saying, well, you know, we brought books for this and we brought books for that. And I was thinking, whose responsibility is it to bring the sort of accoutrement of role-playing games? Because to play most role-playing games, not out there sort of ones, but your typical D&D ones or stuff like that, you need books, you need pencils, you need paper, you need dice. You kind of have to have these things to play.
Oh my God, Chad, you don't need paper and dice in my homebrew system. I will be on the forums very shortly to correct you.
Oh, excellent. You need a wombat, 3 playing cards from 3 different unrelated decks.
There is.
And a stick.
And a Jenga tower.
And a Jenga tower.
There
seems, who brings a Jenga tower?
Well, it seems like historically, there's been this kind of trend in most role-playing groups, which is if we're going to play a game, whoever's going to run it is responsible not only for knowing the game, but owning the game and providing the game. That if there's going to be only one rule book, the GM's got to be the one that gets it. Now, something, though, that we got talking about earlier that kind of seems to have changed that dynamic is it used to be, you know, let's say we were going to play a new game, whatever new game was coming out. You'd have to basically
Shadowrun,
yeah. Ugh. You'd have to go down to the local game store and basically see how many copies of the player's handbook do they even have. You know, we've got 3 or 4 people in the group that want to buy the game, but maybe they've only got 1 or 2 copies sitting on the shelf. We're creatures of impulse. You don't even want to wait on shipping from Amazon. But what seems to have changed that up now is, of course, digital distribution. Because if you're sitting in somebody's basement and they've got a wireless network and you've got your tablet or your laptop or smartphone or whatever it is you use, I mean, you can hop on to Paizo.com, get the Pathfinder Core Rules for $10 in electronic format.
Or Blood Moon Goblins.
Yeah. BloodMoonGoblins.com. Hard copies arrived today.
Arose.
What arose. Wayne is stroking one of the 51 hard copies that I ordered.
That arose.
A couple weeks ago that finally showed up. So watch the mail, goblins. Also, come to Fear the Con and buy one if you haven't already.
God damn it, John, you and your dynamic voice. I'm like, freaking go up.
I have a very dynamic voice when I'm talking about my goblins.
Yeah, you do. Anyway.
So, I mean, really, the question here is, I think there's 2 different kinds of resources for a role-playing game. Physical assets, if you will. There is the practical ones, dice, pencil, paper, books being the probably costliest part of that.
Right.
If we don't count tables, chair, house. If we don't count that,
we take the mortgage out of the equation.
Yeah, we take the mortgage out of the equation. Because that's actually, to me, that's a whole different conversation.
Yeah.
Where to play. But sure. Then there's like a sort of second lower layer of resource that is cups, drinks, snacks, the sort of comfort things. Because in these conversations I was talking about that I was kind of lurking around, not really taking part of, one of the guys said that they I don't provide my players very much, just pencils, paper, and a Keurig. And I'm like, what? Like you provide a coffee maker for them? And somebody chimed in. It's like, oh, yeah, we don't provide much either. It's just like we do, you know, the pencils, paper, and a coffee maker. And I'm like, I drink coffee. Dawn drinks coffee. A lot of people I've gamed with and do currently game with drink coffee. And I've never been in a group that has a role-playing group coffee maker. And, you know, there might be one in the house, but it's more like, hey, do you mind if I use your coffee maker?
It's a Pacific Northwest thing. There's a ton of gamers from the Pacific Northwest, and they're all coffee junkies. So that's why.
No, instead, we have a keg.
Exactly.
Well, it's not a keg. It's draft.
That was why I love my late-night confabs with Keith when we were doing the art. Keith had his little coffee cup, and I had my booze. St. Louis and Olympia coming together.
It's like, I didn't know this was ever an issue. Anheuser-Busch
versus Starbucks.
Yes, exactly. Well, so
the city's defined by their brands.
Well, and see, I don't think it's an issue. I mean, it might be an issue for some people. I'm just sort of like musing on this. Like,
right. Well, let's,
who's
it
where
seems
does the
so simple to me?
Well, it just sort of happens, and I'm kind of looking at it like, how does it happen? Why does it happen?
All right, let's cut to reality, because the answer that ought to be true, and the answer that I think it would be far too easy to fill in the blank here, is, well, you should sit down, figure out what needs to be brought, and everyone does it equally. You know, everyone takes a turn each week, or everyone brings a little
from
something.
Each according to their ability to, each according to their need.
Precisely. Yeah. Let's now look at how the world really works.
The GM does everything.
Well, and that's not necessarily the case.
I've seen two situations when that's not true. One is the game master takes the view, I'm bringing the game. The game is my contribution.
Okay.
Now, let me stop on that one. Do you guys feel that's a fair statement? Do you guys feel if the game master says, I'm bringing the game, it is the job of everyone else, therefore, to say, well, since the game master is taking... Let's presume this is a game that has some preparation. The game master's taking several hours to brainstorm a plot, prep their notes, prep their NPCs. Therefore, as a result, that's their contribution. Everybody else can bring the beer and chips. Does that sound fair to you guys?
If it's at beer and chips, yes. If it's at some sort of rotating dinner purchase, no. I think the GM gets a little bit of an edge. He gets that little kick. He doesn't have to bring beer for everybody.
Yeah, I don't mind sharing my stacks, and I'm not the kind of person who looks around the table and says, Johnny so-and-so has not brought chips in 3 months, nor has he run a game. I give him the stink eye. No, I don't think that at all. But, you know, if I were to, then the person who would be running the game a lot, I would give him a pass. But am I buying a steak and a glass of wine for this guy every gaming session? No.
Well, it's also an interesting dynamic of we've always, for as long as I've been gaming, everyone just occasionally brings stuff in.
Yeah.
We don't talk about it. We don't think about it. We just grab stuff and bring in. And then when Dawn joined the group, she wasn't used to a group that did that.
Right.
So you see her over in the corner. She's got her own sodas off to the side. She has
Dawn
her
makes
own
a nest.
That she
if you look at it, Dawn makes a nest.
Yeah,
she has her bag, and she does. I mean,
there is a Dawn nest. I just took that to a more literal visual, which is very, very funny. Of Dawn sitting there, you know, with straw in her mouth, and you know, and pressing out little mud patterns around her, and that just became a very funny visual.
You are correct.
Maybe doubly so if you can picture Dawn and picture where she sits in past basement. This becomes even funnier. But you know, that's certainly another way of approaching it, is everybody brings their own stuff. I'm kind of in the camp Wayne described and Chad you described as well, which is where I tend to buy in benders. I may go weeks or even months without bringing a single contribution, and then on one particular day I'll show up with two trips to my car of chips and beer because I stopped by Walgreens.
Now, let me ask you this.
That's how I do it.
Let me ask you this then. Because again, this is not, you know, oh, this is a problem that needs to be solved. For me, this is all theoretical. This is like a sociological exercise here. So you don't buy anything for a long time. First question is, well, why? Why don't you buy things for a long time?
We have a backlog.
And then when you do buy, you buy, and I've seen you, you know, you go to Sam's and you do, it's like, boom, and it's like, oh,
which
we're going to
eat
all
this.
Which
is why we have a backlog.
Why do you do that? Why that configuration?
Because for me personally, I tend to operate very much on impulse. Mm. And
boy, do you.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And when I do, I'm the sort of person that when I have any kind of inertia, I have a lot of inertia. Mm-hmm. When I have no inertia, I have no inertia. I mean, I'm a on-off sort of person. There's not a lot of middle ground there, despite how often I use the phrase shades of gray. In terms of the way I live my life, there aren't many of them. There are a lot in my personal kind of sense of values and ethics and whatnot. But
we're talking chips.
Right, but if I walk into a Walgreens, the hardest step's already done. Yeah, I got off my ass and left the house early enough to walk into a Walgreens. At that point, sky's the limit. And so I'm going to go grab.
And sky is the limit because that little turd will eat a lot of chips.
Yes, but, he will.
You know, at that point, it's just I'm going to buy anything and everything that looks even vaguely interesting, load it all up. And like Wayne said, then the way I see it is, look, I've got a backlog. I bought so many chips. It's going to last us for a month or two. We're going to have that weird eclectic collection of one of every kind of beer mankind has ever made, even though they all originally came in six packs in Pat's fridge. And we're not going to need anything for a while. But, you know, kind of backing up a point, there is the ideal and then there's the reality. Mm-hmm. If you talk about group decision making, well, the ideal is we all concede and we give and we take and there's compromise and everybody has a vote. BS. The way the real world works is there alpha personalities and beta personalities. And I'm sure there's people who are going to, you can't, John, do your Louis Armstrong voice for you can't label me.
Let me think about this. I have to come out of the gate swinging as someone arguing for this perspective.
But there's going
to
be somebody who says, oh, you can't label me an alpha. I'm not an alpha or a beta. I'm somewhere in between. Yeah, okay, yeah.
I'm a theta.
Yeah, whatever. Okay, we're all snowflakes. I get it.
I'm an epsilon gamma double bogus. Page 272. In my gaming group with my house rules that doesn't have dice and paper, we do things by acclaim. We have a chimney that has white smoke when we pick a new GM.
Oh my god, I just thought of a new game.
White smoke chimney.
Yeah.
Except that chimney's a Jenga tower, and when it collapses, you've got a pope.
That's right. Yes.
You know,
or an anti-pope.
Or an anti-pope.
Yes. I thought about you this weekend, Chad. All right, so I'm at Anime STL this weekend, and Sarah wants to try out the Maid Cafe.
Right.
So we
what the hell is that? I saw that on your Facebook. I was like, did Wayne go to some sort of cat house?
Maid Cafe is a
Batman year two.
You basically you go over to a giant room. I think you guys dropped by at one point too. You sit down, and all the waitresses are dressed as maids, and then they sit down and they play games with you. The maid.
What kind of game?
So, okay, well,
that was why I thought of Chad, because the game that our maid
played with you.
The game that our maid played with us was Jenga. So I played Jenga there. It's probably the most difficult game of Jenga I've ever played. And I beat her
sweating furiously.
Yeah, I beat her like twice in a row. And I was thinking, I'm only beating her because I've played so much Jenga because of Chad. Mm-hmm. And then she made a comment about, I asked her, you know, hey, were you here last year? Oh, no, I was too young to do this last year.
Uh-huh.
Oh.
So,
okay.
A maid cafe.
You have very stable hands, Wayne-san.
No, we had the shy maid.
All right, you're saying, Jeff.
Then they all got up and they went and danced, and her her cat ears fell off.
So a maid cafe is a real thing. It's in Japan, and there are
sounds like it's in Collinsville now.
Well, that was just an anime con that was trying to.
It's a fun little thing to do. You There's sit two... down, you order drinks, and you kind of just talk with people.
Sounds like a bar.
Well, a real maid cafe.
I'm not sure whether to control my show or just let this bull run.
Let this run.
Let it go.
Okay, very well. Chad, continue.
A real maid, there's different kinds of maid cafes, like real ones in Japan. There's ones that are like what we would consider more legitimate. It's not a sexual thing. It's about the service. They're in a maid outfit, but it's all French revival, and you know, you go there and you drink tea, and you are
so this
there.
Is black French made frilly, like,
yeah, all, okay. And you're there to get served, again, but it's not necessarily, you know, where it's the sexual kinky maid outfit. There's also ones for women to go to that are butlers, guys
and
in tuxedos,
butlers at this maid cafe,
and that sort of thing. Now, that's like the top, if the top end is something that we would consider here in America legitimate. You know, it's a place where we're going for tea and good food and polite conversation. We get to pretend and you know, we get this high degree of service and stuff. Well, on the other end and all points in between of this scale, you have ones that are for the fetishists that are like you pay $200 an hour and you're getting a maid in a kinky maid outfit and you're getting food and she's not there to serve you. She's there to serve you.
So which one was this, Wayne?
This was more the legitimate.
Yeah,
these were kids playing.
Yeah, this was just a fun thing. You go, you sit down.
You know,
they put multiple groups at a table. So you're interacting with other people that are at the convention. It is kind of like a bar thing for people like me that don't go out and drinking and don't like the bar scene. So, except Sarah wanted to do it.
So let me make one comment on that, and then I'm going to go back to who brings supplies to a game. The closest thing I can think of that I have encountered, albeit by a degree of separation, but it's something like this. I was at a previous job. We were getting supplies from China, and we had an electrical engineer who is a Chinese guy here on a student visa getting his PhD at Washington University and also unbelievably intelligent guy. And one of the things that came up culturally about the places that they were going in China to do some of these supply shopping runs and whatnot and company reviews. And there are these places you can go to where, like, you go into this place, you rent a room, you hang out in the room, and, like, you can just, like, watch TV and have drinks or play video games or whatever. And part of the room rental is a couple of young, pretty girls. But there is nothing sexual about it.
It's a hostess club.
But there is nothing sexual about it.
Well,
it's not. Well,
depends on where you go. Right, again, right. We have the scale of legitimacy.
I think there's something subliminally sexual about it.
Yes.
Even if you, because if you go into that and it's a bunch of old fat guys and they're really good at Mario Party, you're still
pissed. It's a hostess club.
Right.
My point being that there's no prostitution, at least in the ones they were describing, the legitimate ones. There's no prostitution involved.
It's a more pitiful form of prostitution. It's the prostitution of a pretty woman acknowledging your existence and not even giving you a handy.
You're getting good service and a good view.
I mean, they have this all over Asia, too. I mean, you go and you get a drink and you pay for company,
right?
To have someone to have a drink with.
Sad.
I'm not saying it's right.
We
wrong,
can talk or, about how sad it gets. They have cafes for these where you go and you just pay to lay down next to a girl.
Oh yeah, they have ones where you pay to sleep with a girl.
Yeah,
and I don't mean sex.
You just sleep
next to a girl, and you pay.
If you want to actually put your arm around them, that costs
extra. Yeah.
Oh my god.
But
so back to who supplies things in a game. I think as much as it feels good to say that everyone should divvy it up, the reality is just like there's alphas and betas, and that's where we got into everybody's a special snowflake, and then I don't know, somehow from that we ended up in maid cafes. But
It was Wayne's fault.
That was my intention, too. I knew I was going to work that story in somehow on this episode.
All right, but in the same way, look, it's going to fall on some people that they're going to bring more than others. It's going to fall that some people, whether because they're busy, they're broke, they feel their contribution is in the form of GMing or whatever, aren't going to bring as much. You know, once again, avoiding the cheap cop-outs here, what is the way that you guys think is ideal? For example, the person who hosts, especially if they're married, they're giving up some degree of political capital by allowing their place to be used, because that's added traffic, added mess. Things are going to get used around the house that they've got to deal with. Does that count as their contribution? They've given you a coffee maker. That's their thing. You know, they gave you a table and a place and the utilities, and that counts as their contribution. Do you guys see that as fair? Or do you think it's, I mean, what's the arrangement here?
Okay, my general
thoughts are, avoiding any cheap cop-outs, what's the arrangement here?
My general thoughts are, as long as, you know, whatever's needed is there, I don't really care how it got there. So everyone, I think, should be responsible for their own dice, because that is their dice.
Yeah.
When it comes to the books, typically if someone wants to run a game, that's a game that somebody has a book for, because otherwise how would they have really known about the game to want to run it? For snacks, I don't expect anybody to provide me any kind of snacks. It is nice that we all as a group bring in these things and we have them there, but I don't expect that to be something anyone provides.
Well, and that's another approach, which we briefly got into there with Dawn's Nest, is everybody's BYOB, basically.
Yeah.
Everybody has snacks, but nobody is providing for anybody else. It's just expected. Whatever it is you want this game, if you want this kind of soda and these kind of chips or this beer or this whatever it is you want, Chris's protein brand spinach shake, whatever, then you bring it. And I'm not going to touch your stuff or take your stuff. But conversely, I'm also not giving you anything.
It's funny when two people or more than two people with each of those mentalities arise at the same time. Because, like, we show up, we throw shit in the fridge and people pull it out and, you know, whatever. Dawn shows up and it goes in the Dawn Nest.
Yeah,
and that's it.
It's her.
And it's like,
We have, for as long as I have been gaming, had a Tupperware box of some sort that is our snack box that we just throw things in. Originally, that was because we were gaming at Dave's house, and if you didn't, the cats would pee on it.
Now it's
just a matter of we're in the habit of doing it.
Yeah. I guess I really internalize it quite a bit. I don't expect anybody to bring anything. I bring stuff, and I don't count any of it as mine. I bring it for everybody. But what I do, we'll say beer, for instance. I bring beer that I like, and I bring beer that I would like to see other people drink and share. Maybe they haven't had it before. But I'm not going to buy Bud Light, even though I know the people at the table who drink beer drink Bud Light.
And I do bring Bud Light.
And you do bring
Bud Light. I have never gone to the store on the way to the game deliberately thinking, this is my contribution as such.
Yeah.
I have had a party, and then a day later or a week later or whatever, opened my fridge and said, this is pornographic. I'm stuffing 30 of these beers at total random into a bag, bringing them over to Pat and Bess and throwing them in the beer fridge in the garage. And I'm writing that off as my contribution to the incidentals.
And somehow, some way, John and I work our way through the beer.
That's right.
And then Beth, who doesn't really drink beer, will say, guys, you're out of beer. God, and she'll remind you. She'll like, guys, you need to pick up some beers. And she's our beer mom, I guess.
At that point, I usually raid my own home fridge for stuff to throw into their garage fridge.
Yeah. I'll usually hit 12 packs.
I mean, I'll stop. I'll do big bags of stuff and bring in. And I never once thought of it as, this is my contribution that I'm making to the group. It's more, I want to bring stuff and put it in there that people enjoy eating. Because I enjoy knowing that what I brought is the snacks that people want to eat.
Yeah, exactly. You know? It's making people happy. And
I get enjoyment out of their enjoyment. I don't just bring stuff that I want. I sometimes bring stuff that I want but can't have.
Yeah.
So like I occasionally will get things
that's torturous.
You bring low sugar and some diet stuff, you share it, and we're just like, this is horrible. Or we're like, this is surprisingly good.
But I also bring, like, occasionally I'll throw something chocolate in there or something that I can't have because I know that other people enjoy it. And I like knowing that the snack that I brought is the one that gets eaten.
The no-sugar multi-flavor taffies were surprisingly good.
They were.
You know, I need to do a public service announcement here to all you vegetarians and vegans out there.
Stop it.
No, well, no. if that's how you want to live...
Fire away, more for me.
Look, if that's how you want to live your life, that is perfectly fine by me. But do not use the following phrase at any point in your life. This tastes exactly like meat. You can't tell the difference. The reason you think that is because you don't f***ing remember what meat tastes like. It does not taste like meat, okay?
Now, that doesn't mean it's bad.
That does not mean it's bad.
Black meat burgers are incredibly good.
Yes, they are.
They don't try to taste like meat.
Precisely. Mm-hmm. But I cannot tell you how many vegetarians and vegans I've had put some mushroom loaf in front of me and tell me it tastes exactly like whatever meat it, and it's like, no, this is not even
my
close.
My favorite one is eggplant chili. Oh, you would never even be able to tell if I put eggplant chili in front of you. Like, yeah, I would. Doesn't have any f-ing meat in it.
The next time I host a game that goes into the Underdark, I'm finding some kind of mushroom patty loaf thing. I'm making you guys eat Underdark stew with glowing fungus lichen appetizers. I think there's some Japanese company that makes fungus chips. I'll go to the nearby Maid Cafe and
we should take a trip sometime to the World Food Mart. I go there all the time.
Oh, let's do it.
I would love to walk through there with you and just point out the things.
Like,
I've thought about buying this, but I thought you guys would think it was really weird.
I'm not going to be at this game, but the game after that, let's meet at the World Food Market like an hour ahead of time and just get the weirdest crap.
Well, here's the real question here. I think we've kind of been dancing around a little bit. Who buys the books? That's the expense right there. You know, even if you spend more money over the course of a year on beer and snacks,
which you do,
it doesn't seem like that big of an expense. It's right. That's food. You always
are buying beer and snacks, whether it's for this or that or the other.
This month I bought $100
over time.
This month I bought $150 worth of beer, chips, and beef jerky. But a $30 roleplay book, I don't know, guys.
Here's my experience. Wrapping out the food and drink one, I got to give props to our group. I've many times described Fear the Boot as a monument to our failures. But in the case of Food and Drink, that's not the case. If I think all the way back through my entire, 25 years now or so of gaming experience, I don't think ever once, to the best of my recollection, there has been an issue in any of the iterations of my gaming groups regarding Food and Drink. This person never brings anything or contributes anything, whereas this person does all the time, and that came down to some huge brawl. I mean, I've seen fights break out over everything. I've seen arguments break out over everything, except that. Our group has done a really good job with that. When it comes down to the books, obviously whoever's running the game has to have the books, because it's really hard to run the game if you don't have the books. Mm-hmm. But who supplies them for the group? I have to agree with you, Chad, that I think certainly there is a psychological hurdle, and that when somebody grabs a six-pack of beer and some chips, you kind of look at those prices individually and you really don't tally them up. You really don't think in your head that I'm about to drop $30 on an armload of snacks. But when you go and pick up one book and flip it over and look at that MSRP right there above the ISBN or whatever, you see that it's $30, $40, $50, depending on the book we're talking about here.
Then, what if it's Tolus?
Then it's $120. And,
but it's going to be supported forever. And it's such a deal.
And that starts to stack up. But, oh, Pim. You know, I really...
Bim.
Bim and the grenades.
I think the easy answer I used to always go to was just that the GM has the book and why do you need only one?
Well,
but... there is nothing more frustrating when creating characters than sitting there and waiting for the book to be passed around.
Or even during gameplay, somebody wants to check
that frustrating.
Somebody checks the stats on this or that, or wants to look over boring. The spells. Right. Yeah, yeah. Try playing a D&D game with Pat. Have only one book.
Oh,
yeah.
My God.
Okay. One of you let him be a Sorka wizard or a wizarder or something. You decided that he would not only know every spell in the book, but would be able to cast them spontaneously whenever he wanted.
Dude, even when
this is your fault.
Even when we locked him down, it did not get much
better.
No.
You're a sorcerer and you have a tiny selection to choose from, or you're a wizard and you have to memorize it at the start of the day.
Pat,
before everyone sits down.
And Pat is an obsessive engineer. Mm-hmm. It's still, even, yes, you are correct. The Sorka wizard thingy was a terrible idea.
That was granted while I was still at law school. If I was at the table, let alone the GM, and I overheard that, I would have been out the door or screaming.
But that continued even after that. Obviously, the Game Master has to have it. Really, from their way, and I think the best layout I've seen is just, look, if people can afford it and are interested in the game and it's becoming a problem, typically somebody will buy it, and usually, not always, but usually who that person is simply whoever has money. I realize people, because of their situation in life, whatever that may be at the moment, have varying levels of disposable income. Now, having said that, yes, I have seen the person where they're a tightwad. They've got their money, and even though they've got the free income to spend, and even though it's screwing up the game because we've only got one player's handbook, they will not drop the money to get a second copy and make everyone else's life a whole lot easier. And instead, it ends up falling to the guy across the table who doesn't have as much disposable income, but isn't as much of a tightwad with their money. And I think, once again, we can have this great ideal of...
from each according to their ability to each according to their needs.
I mean, it's a great ideal. But
no, it's not. It's communism.
But it's not the reality of how things work. You know, it's not how things play out. And it seems to really end up falling upon not the person who is most able, but the person who is most willing.
This is getting easier, though, with technology when you start looking at it. A lot of the things that it's not even just technology, it's some of the decisions that game makers are making now. But let's look at, say, Pathfinder or D&D 3. You've got the SRDs out there. So you have devices, whether they be phones, laptops, whatever, and you can access online everything they need.
Those are free.
Also,
you've got PDF copies that are of 600-page books that cost $9.99.
Yep. And what I've noticed is a trend, not every game's doing this, obviously, but some games now, when you buy the core rule book, they give you the ability to go out there and grab digital copies of the player's manual. For all your players.
Yeah, and you're also right. There's a lot of things, Wayne, that are completely free. Whether we're talking about the SRD or was it the PFRD or whatever the heck it's called.
The PFSRD is just the SRD for Pathfinder.
There's, yeah, but there's another one, I thought. There's the
an official one on Paizo, but then
there there's the system resource document, and there's another one that has a different abbreviation. It stands for something else. I just can't remember off the top of my head what it stands for.
Oh, that was Gleemax. That's still there, no. But it takes $15 a month.
No, I
But don't worry, everyone will subscribe to it. It's just like, wow.
Yeah. It'll always be supported.
Yeah.
I don't think Gleemax would have come to mind for anything.
Gleemax wasn't mind.
Outside of that punchline. Except for the fact that Gamer Zero was a really cool guy.
I was going to say, I was just thinking about that. Remember they had a podcast that supported it?
And they made a terrible mistake and a pandering mistake at that when they decided to kick him off for a cute girl. It was a stupid and pandering mistake because Gamer Zero was a freaking great guy. Not that I have any beef with this other girl. I actually never really met her or talked to her. It's just I disagree.
You hate other girl.
No, I hate freaking WotC and the vast majority of the decisions they make. And not be simply because it's popular to do so. Anyway.
We've hated them before it was popular.
Yeah, we hated them before it was cool to hate, though. We hated them back when they were TSR.
That's right. Screw that.
I liked TSR.
No, I know. I know. WotC was never TSR. They're different companies.
I never experienced TSR.
I'm just being belligerent.
Oh, you missed the good days. When they were printing new campaign settings like Weimar Deutschmark, wheelbarrows full of boxes at KB Toys that are like entirely brand new box sets of campaigns starting from nowhere with 500 page supplements.
When you see a picture, somebody posts a picture online of, here's my gaming collection, it takes up 50 feet of bookshelves and it's floor to ceiling, and it's hundreds and hundreds of books. Most of that is D&D.
Is late second edition. Library of Congress suffocating book sprawl.
Yeah.
And that's how
book sprawl.
That's how we got third edition.
Yeah. I saw a great TSR one the other day. Somebody had a picture of their e-reader and they're like, here's my RPG collection.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, here's mine. I have it all on my iPhone. Beat that.
I'd rather have the physical.
So, I have my brain. Where all my games
I have
are.
One six-sided dice.
It's like the Bibles that they flew into space and took to the moon or whatever, you know, where they're little tiny things like an inch by an inch or whatever, and they had the entire King James Bible printed on it. Nice. That's like my gaming collection. You need a electron microscope.
Oh my God, they totally did that with first edition D&D. They made these little tiny, not inch by inch, but they were awesome. That was one of those things, you know how when you collect something or you buy, you're into a hobby and you see something at your hobby, you really have to impulse buy it because you could you might never see it again. That was one of those things. I saw it and I'm like, wow, that is so cool. But I'll pick it up next week. 3 weeks from now, then I walk the store and it's gone. And
that's
never see
part
it
of the reason I have such poor impulse control when it comes to buying, because I'm afraid if I don't act now, one of two things will happen. Either one, it won't be there, or two, I'll wisen up and not buy it.
Well, and you know what? Ultimately, though, that saved me from not impulse buying it.
Right.
Because A, I would never, ever actually use it. It was just a cool thing.
Right.
And B, it's not crapping up my house.
Right.
Unlike you know my anti-impulse buy, Dan? I think this might work for you, too. If there's something I find that I want to buy it. I'm in the store. I want to buy it. I'll pick it up. I'll carry it around with me. After 5 minutes, I'm probably going to set it back down.
Really? For me, that's it.
That's sales clothes. Actually, they teach you that in salesman school. What you do is you go up to a person and you hand them the book or whatever.
Because the moment it's in their hand, they don't want to let go of it.
Then what you do,
I'm the opposite.
As you're selling the product, you take it out of their hands.
Because now they feel like they've lost something. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Wayne, let me give you a slightly different one. Let's say you walked into a pet store and I put a puppy in your hand.
Oh, that's different.
Yeah. See, okay, that's what I'm saying. For me, that's it. If it's in my hand, if I picked it up, there has to be like a really compelling reason like, oh, this is the wrong brand. I'm meant to buy Imodium and this is a laxative. I mean, it's got to be something on that level before I'm
going
to put it back.
My head is constantly trying to convince me not to buy whatever I'm holding. So the longer I walk around the store, the more likely I'll convince myself that I don't really need
buyer's
this.
Buyer's remorse takes much longer set in than that for me. I have to actually make the purchase before I get buyer's remorse. All right.
I have to pick it up and look at it and think, okay, John, are you really going to stop watching your TiVo shows, reading your books, and playing StarCraft and consume this piece of media? Or are you just going to get home and throw it on your floor and do those things instead? And usually whatever I'm holding fails that particular audit and I don't buy it.
That's why I love demos and samples. You will get me to buy something if I can get some sort of demo or sample of it.
You know the secret to selling something to me? You put it in a bag or a box and you don't let me see what it is. And you write grab bag on it. Because my imagination of what's in that bag is better than what's in that bag.
I would not do that at a pet store. I just want you to grab bag.
$10 full of tarantulas.
Yeah, exactly. I wanted a puppy and I got a bunch of tarantulas and now they're running all over my house.
Tarantulas are benevolent beasts. I'd be more worried about
moccasins. Until they start shooting their urticating hairs at you and then it's somewhat
different. Only if you like pet them real close. Yeah.
I am a sucker.
Or they get mad at you and they do that thing with their legs and shoot the freaking urticating hairs at you. That was a dumbass we used to hang out with who was raising, was it? Some hideously lethal scorpion breed. Anyway,
and see, and I don't get. I am a sucker for grab bags, but I know whatever's in the grab bag is what they couldn't sell,
like the scorpion.
Yeah, like the scorpion. No one went to buy the scorpion, so they put it in a grab bag.
Wayne and I were at this,
or the copperhead that they thought was a ball python at first.
Wayne and I were at this anime STL together,
right?
And I see the grab. Wayne sees the grab bags, and he's like, "Oh, what could be in it?" And he, you have to make a logical argument with yourself, like, "Oh, this is blah blah blah," and then, okay, that's why I'm not going to buy. I look at it and go, "I'm not going to give you $20 for a brown paper bag with bullshit in it."
I bought three.
I don't know. I see. I looked at it and I'm like,
"I bought three,
Chad."
I think there's a form of gambling.
How many stars on Amazon does this grab bag get?
I want you
to know, the consumer reviews
that line right there, that needs to be reread by Samuel L. Jackson. That line right there, but I'm not going to give you the $20. Well, that entire sentence needs to be re-edited in by Samuel L. Jackson. So Samuel Jackson, if you are secretly a closeted booter, this is your opportunity.
It's time to come out of the closet.
We have finally called you out on the show. Your day has come. All right, let's get to a gaming topic here before I have to bonus episode this. We got a tweet from a guy named Jason Taylor. This, I think, was actually a while back.
And he is secretly Samuel L. Jackson.
Yes, he is, in fact, Samuel L. Jackson. And there are actually two topics we have that kind of tie together, and I thought we'd hit them both this episode, and then Maid Cafe happened, and that didn't happen. So anyway,
you know, you say that, but you like girls. You like girls in skimpy dresses, and you like girls in skimpy dresses serving you food.
I wasn't there. The only visual I have is Wayne horny, and that just didn't do a whole lot for me.
What?
There was no horny involved, and we were there because my wife wanted to go to the Maid Cafe.
Excuses!
The sweet music of justification.
There are two topics we've got that tie together. One came from Jason Taylor. One came, I believe, internally. I'd have to check the thread history to see where we got it from. And so this episode and the next episode are going to tie pretty closely together thematically. Both of them deal with scale, the scale of a game and the events that happen within a game. Now, the broader topic that I want to get to next time is the different scales that a game can occur at and how you can tell different kinds of stories depending on the scale of the game. All right, whether it's an epic game versus whether it's just something that deals with a really minor series of events surrounding a small number of people that don't have grand galactic significance. We'll get to that next time. But the question that Jason Taylor raised, I think this is a great one, is he wants to know about dealing with mass scale combat and yet having the players have a meaningful role. Okay, so what we're not talking about here, we're not talking about abstracting combat. We're not talking about there's a castle siege underway and how do you roll out who wins the castle siege? I know there are supplements for that in just about every major game system out there. That's not what the question is. The question is, let's say that you've got army fighting army and your party is caught up in this and you want them to have some kind of a meaningful impact and yet do so plausibly. That's where I want to start this, is I think there are some cheap answers to this that aren't necessarily bad answers. I call them cheap because they're easy, but depending on the game you're running,
easy and cheap.
Goddamn right I am. But these may be right for your game, but let me start with the easy ones. Then I'm going to move to some, I think, what are some slightly more complex ones. The easy ones are the party is either doing the most important thing. There may be a whole fleet out there doing a screening action, but you're the X-Wings and Y-Wings doing the trench run. That's option number one. Option number two is maybe you're not doing the most significant things, but you are the most powerful presence on the field. D&D is a great example of this. You're surrounded by a bunch of level one commoners and then level one and two sergeants and level three captains, maybe the one level five court wizard. and your party of level 15 characters. Obviously, your presence on that battlefield is a game changer, regardless of how many enemies there are. Wherever you stand, the battle's ebbing and flowing around you. What is that video game series that plays like that?
Dynasty Warriors?
Yeah, Dynasty Warriors, where you have this army, and the army only kind of matters. Yeah. It's really about the guy that you're playing. And those certainly work in certain kinds of games. And depending on the story you're telling, these may be the right answer. Simply to have the players be the most powerful characters on the field, or to have them be doing the most important act. Theirs is the act upon which the battle hinges. Really, the rest of the battle, while it needs to occur, if the fleet stops the screening action, the guys in the trench run get overwhelmed. But ultimately, it's not a consequential or dynamic event.
I guess the question is, as a game master, is the player's actions, whether they're low man on the totem pole or high man on the totem pole, is the player's action actually going to determine the outcome of the battle? Or is it not?
Right.
Because if it's not, and that's cool, that's actually all right to do, because that means the battle and everybody in it, whether they're super powerful gods or they're just lowly schmucks, it's just a setting.
Well, and yeah, you were playing a soldier on D-Day.
Yeah.
We know how D-Day is going to end. That doesn't mean you can't have a good game.
Right.
Yeah. Where you're starting off being a soldier.
And I think there are several ways to skin that cat, because you can have the action matter without it being the only action that matters.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go back to the trench run analogy. Okay, maybe you're not doing the trench run. You're part of the screening group, but somebody hit Control R and there's a detachment of TIE fighters headed towards the guys in the trench. You're part of the squadron that has to intercept them. If you don't intercept them, this battle is lost. But if you do intercept them, you're still not the one that gets the medal at the end of the movie. Mm. And so I think there are still ways of doing things that matter without necessarily having you be the most epic part of the battle. Once you're not saying that you can't be the most epic part of the battle, but just saying...
Now I want to play TIE Fighter again. It's damn Control
Every
R.
Every morning I wake up, there's a little bit of me that just wants to play TIE Fighter today.
John, you know what? You notice right now I've got my shirt sleeve pulled back. You know why that is.
I'm looking, of course it is.
Look to see how many circles there are on my left forearm.
Welcome to the Secret Order of the Emperor.
So secret, no fanboy has ever heard of it before until this game.
Serve the Emperor above all others.
There's another solution to this. Chad, I want to talk about a Battletech game we played, but before I do...
I don't remember it.
No. I'm not going to ask you about the Battletech game.
Thank God.
I want to ask you about the campaign that you ran before the Battletech campaign. Maybe not immediately before, but...
I still don't remember.
You don't remember the chess pieces and fighting over the city?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So there was another approach to handing...
You didn't remember not remember.
This was kind of a different approach where what Chad did, and once again, we're not talking about resolution of mass combat, so while that was part of this, I don't want to focus on that.
Yeah.
But what Chad did in this was he set up the city streets and whatnot, kind of abstracted it out, and we had little chess pieces that this represented a squad of soldiers, or this represented a major monster like a golem that someone was controlling or whatnot. But then our individual characters were represented, but because of the fact that we were these powerful presences, what Chad did was he gave us special abilities to affect the battle. Mm-hmm. So in addition to one of us having similar power to a detachment of soldiers, which I realize is kind of out of place in some games, but in D&D that's how the world works.
Yeah.
But on top of that, we had special powers. In addition to whatever attack or defense rating we had, based on the characters, you know, like, Pat had certain spells he could cast.
Mm-hmm.
All of them.
As a
But he only cast three.
As a Noel, I don't remember what my powers were, but it was something like I could go into these rage modes, or I could call in a Noel pack to assist me or whatever. I don't remember what all the powers were, but people would kind of, you know, disappear and reappear in different parts of the city. But we had these flex powers. Now, let's for a moment take the mass combat out of the picture. Let's say that you're just trying to deal with the castle's getting sieged. You're just on one little area, one little parapet of the castle. It's not the most important one, but maybe nonetheless, you have some ability where you see a detachment of soldiers that are going toward the main portcullis, But because of who you are and what you are, you have unique ability to affect the ebb and flow of the battle around you. And so maybe you have some way of kind of cutting them off. And so the game master is going to take that into account when they resolve that. There was a solution that we had in the Battletech game that we played after that, which this is the one that I personally lean toward because I think it does the best job of making the players feel significant without necessarily pandering to them as the big heroes and stars of the game. Let me reiterate yet again, I'm not condemning that. That's just not the kind of feel of a game that we typically are going for. I realize there are some people where after spending their whole day balancing spreadsheets, they want to be the hero. They don't want to be another cog in the machine. And I'm not talking about a cog in the Gears of War sense here. But what we did with Battletech was you guys participated in actions that were all the way down to lance on lance. You know, these were very small skirmishes and backwater planets where whatever mech force you guys had, whatever mech force they had, that represented the sum of the combatants, the sum of the belligerents in this action. But there were other battles that you guys participated in where it was regiments, plural, on regiments. Now, for anyone who's not familiar with Battletech, what that means is what these guys brought to the field may have been somewhere between 4, 8, maybe 12 mechs. But all total, there were hundreds, maybe even thousands of mechs, and probably 10 times as many vehicles and 10 times as many infantrymen that were participating in this. So you had these large-scale wars going on. But what I would do is I would look at it in the same way that you look at a real war. You have objectives, and these objectives all matter. So there's a power plant over here. And if you can secure the power plant, you can shut down the power grid for an automated defense system that's over here. Now, you guys aren't involved in that battle. You're never going to see that automated defense grid. But you know suddenly that what you are doing is more than just, yeah, there's eight of you, go kill eight of them. There's a sense of context. And that's the part here that I want to focus on, is you can give significance by giving context, by helping the players understand why even if what they're doing is small, it really matters. If you're knocking out three or four artillery pieces, okay, it's just a handful of you versus a handful of them. But knocking out those artillery pieces means the beachhead isn't getting bombarded. And that part of the invasion moves forward. And based on how you've chosen to abstract the battle, you can then say, okay, if you knock out the artillery pieces, the invaders get an extra die. If you don't, the defenders get an extra die. I'm not really going to get into that because that's a different discussion.
That actually was the part that really made it feel like we were having an impact, though, is that you were rolling on the side for the major battles going on. But knowing that if we are successful here, there's going to be a bonus in that big roll that you're doing off to the side.
Sure.
That actually helped with the idea of we're helping the larger fight.
Well, and sometimes I was even able to make it a little bit more direct. Rather than just looking at the bigger fight, I could look at the small fight and I could say, okay, this is Battletech. It's all about resource management. You know, you've got so many repair supplies, so many techs, so many man hours of repairs you can do between battles. You can go straight to the main fortress, but you're going to be fighting this level of enemies, and there's this likelihood of them getting reinforcements. However, on the way there, you can stop off and fight a battle in a gulch. They tend to send the reinforcements down. You're going to get some beat-up damage doing this, but if you're willing to take that gamble, and things could, of course, go seriously awry, but if you're willing to take that gamble, then by the time you get to the main fortress, they're going to have weaker forces, and they're going to have either less reinforcements or maybe no reinforcements at all. And so you guys are kind of deciding some of your own fate. And then on top of that, I, as a game master, have to explain to you the importance of this fortress. This fortress overlooks a major hill of the battlefield. And if you can take it out, then you have taken out their ability to project power over this entire battlefield, which is going to let recon lances get through, which is going to let fast fire support get through, which is going to let them set up a temporary aerospace refueling point. You know, this matters in the scheme of the battle. And explaining that context can take even a minor objective and suddenly make it feel like it matters.
I'm facing this situation right now in my Wednesday Pathfinder game. I have a set of player characters who run between second and fourth level facing a titanic surprise attack by a necromancer cult on a city that's much bigger than them, that's full of NPCs that are much more powerful than them on the good guy and the bad guy side. So I may appropriate some of this information tomorrow as I set the battle. I will probably have them set up at some sort of juncture point, perhaps a landing zone that they happen to be right next to at the moment that the Wizard College can't get to. They'll get a message from a diviner or something that says, hold this sewer grate, and you'll catch a very powerful necromancer who isn't ready to be punched in the nose just quite yet. And if you can take him down with the jump on him, you'll be massive, massive contributors to the total victory.
You know, I think there's also something you can look at in situations like that, which is having an indirect role. Let's say in your game you've got this necromancer thing going on. Okay, maybe these guys can't affect the war. Maybe they can't defeat the necromancer. But if they can somehow do something to kind of spook him a little bit, make him think that his home is being threatened, catch one of his minions and give him false intel or something like that. And there's these little ways in which they can impact big events through small actions where they can use misdirection, subterfuge, assassination, theft, intrigue, all these different options to try and throw off these much larger actions. And once again, here you have, yes, there's a mass situation occurring. There's this mass combat that's eventually inevitably going to occur, but the players still have a meaningful role because of the fact that there's a situation they immediately impact and the context of that situation has been well described.
I'm going to do exactly what I said a minute ago. I'm going to set an encounter that's well over their appropriate challenge rating, but I'm going to hamstring. I'm going to make it just one or two arcane casters who are not ready for it. They're not going to have their wizard or their mage armor. They're not going to have their shield. They're going to be necromancers who don't have necromantic minions, and I'm going to see how they can handle that.
So stealing an idea from some video games that I've played, I've always liked the idea of you're in the you're in the big battle, everything's going on, and a general or somebody who's ranking above you just kind of turns to you. We have reports that they've broken our lines. The orphanage, because you're talking a village, yeah. You know, the orphanage is at risk. The group having these small victories, you know, if they're not impacting the major battle, maybe they're winning the smaller battles. Yeah. It's like, we are holding the line. We cannot take anyone else
the major
off the
battle. But like we were saying, they are not the decisive
right.
force.
Well, if it's something where you didn't necessarily want that.
But you know what that gives, Wayne? Defending the orphanage? That's going to feel like a hell of a victory to you.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's where the battle is a setting.
Yeah. And I pick orphanage because it pulls at the heartstring. It could be they're about to burn our food supply.
Could be a puppy orphanage.
I would go rescue the puppy orphanage.
They could be wounded military service dogs.
No, it could be the
Derek.
It could be children of wounded military service dogs.
Puppies.
Yes, the puppies.
Who have been wounded themselves and need more dogs.
Who lost their mommy and daddy puppy doggy too.
When they were fighting in the war against the bad men.
Yes, they're...
And they have really big eyes.
But the key is, you know, maybe that is a smaller victory that they can have that would give them that sense of accomplishment as well as affecting the bigger war.
Here's another bit of...
I gotta go save those puppies.
Here's another bit of puppy advice that I have that I think is kind of important, which is, Game Masters, if you're looking for something like this that's a little more interesting than just making them the center of the battle, the first step you've got to do to make that work is you have to understand the conflict on a more complex level. Now, what I mean by that is, let's say you have an army-on-army action that's occurring.
Hot army-on-army action.
That is a new line of pornography from Pat Studios.
Yeah, it's called the History Channel.
Right.
It's called Action Girls.
But if you just kind of look at it and say, well, they've got two regiments of mechs, you've got two regiments of mechs, this force of 250 versus 250, plus all their vehicles and infantry are going to clash in this big valley, and that's where it's all going to occur, and you're in the middle of that. It is really, really hard to make anyone in that battle feel significant, unless you give them a really cheesy setup where it's like, but you found the command lance, and you can cut off the head of the beast. Okay, maybe there's a place for that, but you know what? That gets old after a while. Look at the Somme, you know, the battle lines that sat there for months, if not years, there was just this meat grinder during World War One. Look, it's really hard to pick anything important out of that because it was just this huge wave on wave, and one side won and one side lost, and really both sides lost, and it was a horrible, horrible situation. But if you start to look at the battle and its pieces, you start to say, look, wars don't always consist of two people taking all their armies and throwing them at each other. Wars consist of more complex individual actions. You know, yes, there may be a main battle force, but we're going to divide it. One's going to try and take a bridge. Another's going to try and take an oil refinery. These two things hurt the enemy's war effort and control the battlefield. And then the two are going to come together in a pincer attack on a town. There's more complexity to what's going on. We're in a castle siege. Okay, we're trying to siege this castle. There are some people that are trying to fell timber to create the siege machines. There are some people that are trying to stop up the water supply. There are some people that are trying to slip through the gates of the castle to lower morale by sitting in the middle of the town square and doom wailing about how they're all going to die.
Or burning the food or attacking the orphanage.
Or there's another
not
group.
The puppies.
There's another group that's trying to stop the runners who are running through the gate, who are headed to Gondor to get reinforcements. And you start to look at the battle in its discrete parts. And now all of a sudden, the opportunities for a small group to make a difference start to become more apparent. I think a great way to look at this is, let's go back to an example we used earlier, which is the Normandy invasions. Yes, there were these big waves of troops that fought it out on the beaches of France. But there were also a whole lot of paratroopers, forward actions, spies, you know, all these things that occurred that made that battle possible. And there were all these, and even once the major armies were there, once they had got the beachheads established, there were roads they had to take, bridges they had to take, towns they had to liberate. These wars were not just the Americans and British got in one big line and the Germans got in one big line and they just ran into each other and one side won. That is not how World War II went down. And I think when people run wars or large-scale military actions in role-playing games, it is very tempting to just say, they've got 1,000 warships and you've got 1,000 warships. Let's roll that out. And it is really hard in that kind of a hum to make any particular piece feel significant. That's, I think, where we're going to leave this one. Like I said, we're going to come back to this topic from a slightly different angle, which is the scale of storytelling in general. But we'll save that for next time since this episode got waned.
This may be the first intentional one. Usually it just happens.
You've had some stories that are not accidental.
It usually is. It usually someone will say something, it'll trigger a memory. This time I was wanting to tell that story.
Wayne has flashbacks to the depths of the Hostess Cafe anytime he hears a traffic helicopter.
Okay, so thank you guys for tuning in. Yeah. Check the show notes for some cool stuff. Once again, if you're coming to Fear the Con 6, we'll be seeing you guys in short order. Whether you're coming or not coming, be sure to check the show notes for a link to Cafe Press to
but come.
Convention t-shirts. Have a great week and great games, and we will catch you next time.
See you.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2013. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.